Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren, and co-host, cohort, whatever you call it.
Ready show shotgun.
Yeah, back. David Rose. Bad Back Martino.
Bad Back Martino, yeah.
If you're practicing your karate again, you know. That's
just, yeah, just threw my back out. Right?
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Terrible.
I think it's I know the truth. I know. It was because your wife, you didn't take her to the Run DMC concert. So
that's right. And she put me in a joint lock. And
yeah, and she threw me on the ground. The stairs a couple of times. Well, I'll tell you.
There's no video of it, so it didn't happen.
Yeah. You take the back seat. You deserve it anyway.
I do.
Like I said, it could be worse. You could be on a... No, never mind. I'm not going to be able to stay. That was... I know I'm going to get in trouble for that. So I think I better stay away from that section because, you know, we get in trouble all the time.
Mm.
Well, anyway, we've got another great show coming up. Now, we're going to be talking to an author again. Jeez, we're doing a lot of authors lately. Should take up writing. Yes. Well, this guy, he's got a new book out called Shoot the Moonlight Out. And this is the, I don't know, it looks like he's done a lot of books, at least 5, 6 here. William Boyle, thank you for being on the show.
Oh, yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, we'll see if you say that at the end of the show. You might see if you don't. You know, we've only kicked one person out this week, so.
True.
Well, that was beyond when you start talking about the Bilderbergs and all that conspiracy stuff and lizard people. It was like, come on, I'm done. You know, we're done. You haven't seen any lizard people lately, have you, over in New York?
No. I'm actually in Mississippi, so I'm from New York. And I live in Mississippi, so maybe I did. Maybe I didn't. They're just kind of undercover lizard people.
Yeah, because you know, you just never know. Do you like to write about lizards or no?
I don't think I've ever written about a lizard, and I don't anticipate writing about one.
Now, it could be a great add-on to your next book. Think about it.
Yeah, maybe. I will. I'll put some thought into it.
Yeah, they come out, and they're really a lizard in there. It looks like you – now, so you are – how do you consider yourself? What kind of writer? Like crime fiction sort of writer?
Yeah. I generally call myself a crime writer.
How did that come about? Like what got you into the crime fiction?
I loved crime fiction from a pretty young age. I was, getting assigned stuff in school that I didn't like. And when I was around 10 or 11, I started reading writers like Ed McBain, and I just kind of tapped into that world, and you know, just kept discovering stuff at the library and read Elmer Leonard and Jim Thompson and James Ellroy and a bunch of writers like that when I was pretty young. And so I had a taste for it as a kid, and then kind of my tastes go all over the place, but I think when I finally started to figure out who I was as a writer, I mean, I've always written and always wanted to be a writer, but I kind of didn't know what I wanted to do, if I wanted to write poetry or write screenplays or write plays or whatever. But by the time I was about 18, I guess I'd figured out that I wanted to write fiction, and my taste was all over the place, like I said, but I, you know, probably by my mid-20s or early 20s, I kind of figured out that I wanted to write character-driven, place-driven crime fiction.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting, but was there a particular incident that ignited your thing to write? Because, and I say that because, I mean, we both write here, right? And of course, I published books, but I don't consider myself a good writer. So what got you brave enough to actually decide that you should publish these books?
I don't know if there was one particular incident. It was just kind of one of those things that I always wanted as a kid. I just started, you know, pretty much as far back as I can remember, certainly age 7 or so, I was writing stories, and by high school I was writing a lot and pretty weirdly pretty disciplined. I mean, I was writing garbage, but I was working hard at it. It took me a while. I didn't have a model for it, really. I mean, I knew there were writers I loved, and I loved going to bookstores and libraries, but I didn't know any writers, really. And so it was really not until my early 30s that I started publishing.
But I guess what I'm saying is you mustn't really have a fear then. Like you write and you put it out and you have enough confidence that you're not really worried about people that dislike it or say bad things.
No, I mean, yeah, I think I've always had kind of a thick skin when it comes to that stuff. I kind of have a mentality of just like, you just have to be able to take those punches. Otherwise you're just not going to make it. You can't be that sensitive about it. Most people probably aren't going to read it, number one. And then the people that do are going to be split on whether they like it or not. So, different people have different tastes. And I just, you know, I try to approach it. I'm a huge fan of so much stuff, you know, books and movies and music. I just kind of try to think about it as a fan. You know, I'm not that way. I kind of talk about, there's stuff I don't like, but I don't generally talk about that stuff. I kind of focus on the stuff I love.
Yeah. Well, you're from Brooklyn. You're tough. but well, not only that. Yeah. I don't really understand today's culture in the sense of, you know, you turn on a radio show, you think, oh, this is garbage, or I don't like it. You flip the channel, right? Or just like you get a book and you read it and go, oh, it's not my style. But people love to comment, get online, you know.
Yeah.
Get a big thing going, because, which I'm not sure why, because why not just do something else, you know? But, you know, that's the world.
I don't get it. There's no value in it for me. It kind of makes me feel bad about things, you know. And what doesn't make me feel bad about things is talking about stuff I love, you know. That makes me feel productive and you know, feels more meaningful.
Now, I noticed this is they've classified your new book as vigilante justice thrillers. Okay. So are we talking about like the old you know, what was that, Death Wish type? Remember with Charles Bronson?
yeah. Actually, based on a really good novel by a writer named John Garfield. I don't know. I wouldn't quite. They use a lot of classification terms for books. I don't really think of it as a vigilante book, though there is a little bit of that thread in the book. There's a character who is is kind of doling out neighborhood justice. But yeah, it's kind of, it's, you know, maybe a little bit of a misleading tag. It's certainly not the, not the whole of the book. It's one little thread in the book.
Well, that's interesting. So now when you go to write this book, for instance, like you're talking about, the characters, so, and you like character driven sort of stories. So where do you get your characters from? Like, how do they come to you?
A variety of places, I guess. You know, I like ensemble casts. I like big sprawling casts. And this novel is, set in the, it starts in 1996, and then the bulk of it is set in June of 2001 in southern Brooklyn. So I definitely kind of go back to my memories of growing up there and people I knew. I use a little bit of that. I certainly draw from my own experiences. But I also like just making stuff up, and I like kind of the mythology aspect of writing about Brooklyn, and so you know, there's a lot of different places they come from. You know, I'm influenced certainly by books I'm reading and movies I'm watching, and so I think all that stuff kind of gets filtered in there in some way.
Yeah, and so the title itself, "Shoot the Moonlight Out," where does that come from? What does that mean?
It comes from there's a musician I really love named Garland Jeffries. And he was kind of a big discovery for me. I got into him through Lou Reed. I really love Lou Reed, and I read an interview with Lou Reed somewhere along the line, and he was talking about Garland Jeffries, who was putting out albums he's still putting out records actually that are really good. But he kind of came on the scene in the 70s, New York guy. And so this album, this is a song title of his, "Shoot the Moonlight Out." It's a song I really love. And I just kind of, you know, I very often for titles, I think I'm either thinking about place names or song titles. And so this was a song title that just kind of just inspired me and prompted something in me, and I kind of sat down with the title and started working from there. I mean, it's got no real connection to the book has no connection to the song beyond kind of the tone and atmosphere it helped me create, but it was just a title I loved, and I started going from there.
Now, you mostly write about Brooklyn and Brooklyn of the past, and you know, I know you grew up in Brooklyn, but is there something specific about Brooklyn that calls to you to write these books?
You know, it's just, especially the last couple of books, I've gone back to the 90s and the early 2000s and kind of the time that I lived there most intimately. So I think, you know, I'm a big advocate of writing about what haunts you, and that's the place that haunts me the most. It's where I grew up. It's where I, you know, my family is still there. I'm not currently there, but, I just go there when I sit down to write. It's the place that I automatically return to. And I feel like I've kind of been over a few books, been building a version of my Brooklyn, you know, kind of blend of the Brooklyn I've known and some mythological, imaginary Brooklyn. And it's just kind of the, I don't know, I've been populating it with people and kind of, you know, there are characters I will drop into one book for a page and then, you know, think about and wonder about and want to return to in another book. So I think it's just kind of this, the place that I go, the place I want to spend time when I'm writing.
So in a way, you're kind of writing New York as a character itself.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, at least my version of it. Yeah. Or the way I've known it, the way I've seen it, the way I imagine it. It's a big character. I mean, I've always, like I said, I've always loved and responded to stuff that is really rooted in place. So, you know, when I live in Mississippi now, I live in Oxford, Mississippi, and one of the things that drew me down here originally was the writer Larry Brown, who I love. And he, you know, the way he wrote about Mississippi was the way ultimately I wanted to write about New York. And so that was a big, influence in terms of thinking about place early on.
Well, yeah. So your main character, if you were to describe, like, I guess you do an ensemble, but I think, what is it? It's, I can't even say his last name, Bobby Santovasco.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. good name. How would you describe that character?
He's kind of, I mean, he's to me not really the main character of the book, but definitely one of the three or four main characters. He's a young character. The book opens with him. He's a kid in the first section, and then just a little bit older in the rest of the book. And he's a character who does, in the opening chapter, in the prologue, I should say, does something stupid that spins out of control and has fatal consequences. And so he's a character that's shaped by that bad decision and becomes kind of self-destructive. But then it also opens up into something else for him as he tries to get away from that. So he's one of the main characters. And I think I always kind of tend to alternate between younger characters who are wanting to get out of the neighborhood and older characters who are stuck in the neighborhood. And they're both kind of, or, you know, settled in the neighborhood, I should say, I guess. The younger characters often feel trapped and want to escape. And the older characters have kind of settled into their way of living, or, you know, given up or whatever.
When you write these characters like Bobby and some of these other younger, older characters, can you hear their voices in your head? I mean, I know I hear voices when I write, but I just wonder if you can, if you hear them, if you're more translating what you're seeing in your mind, images, and turning that into prose.
Oh yeah, that's an interesting thing to think about. I don't know. Yeah, I definitely hear something. You know, I love dialogue, and I've always loved writing dialogue. And you know, as a kid, I used to just sit around and tape my grandparents talking, and then transcribe their conversations. And so I do. I think when I'm writing dialogue, I do hear kind of the, you know, hear their voices to a certain extent. I definitely, you know, hear kind of rhythms of speaking, you know, the way people speak. I don't know that it's, you know, crystal clear, like I'm hearing a certain person saying something a certain way, but there's definitely kind of an interior thing going on for me when I'm writing dialogue. And the same goes for just kind of seeing it. I mean, you know, definitely, you know, I love films, and I'm definitely inspired by a lot of films. So there's part of me that is seeing the action unfold as if it were a movie, or, you know, seeing certain actors in certain roles, things like that.
Yeah, well, that's all right. And don't worry, Dave's a little bit insane, so, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
He hears voices, and they tell him to do things, and it kind of gets a little crazy at times, right? So you just, you know, kind of keep your distance from him, you know. Do you actually take real people in your life and make them characters? Or if you're like at a, let's say you've gone to the store, you're going through the drive-thru to get some sort of McDonald's or something, and someone cuts you off or someone does something rude, do you take that person and put them in your book and maybe have them tortured or shot? I'm asking for a friend.
Yeah, you know, I definitely use, I've used, to a certain extent, I've used parts of people, I'd say. I'm definitely, you know, writing is so much about observation, about what you see, and kind of collecting things along the way. So there, you know, I think subconsciously, even there are things that are always showing up in what you're working on, or in what I'm working on. You know, there's not usually some very specific things where I've totally based someone on someone that I know or have seen, but definitely pieces of people are kind of always showing up. I mean, certainly pieces of myself are always showing up in characters, and pieces of my mom and my grandparents are kind of always showing up in characters, but not probably some in a case like that, probably that's not something I would use. But if it was somebody I'd kind of known well, they would probably in some way, even in disguise, kind of show up in the text.
Okay, give us some names here. Let's get to the real stuff here. Who are you torturing in your books? Right? People want to know.
Yeah. Would you well, there is well, there is one. Yeah,
oh, no, okay, kidding. Perfect.
No,
there we go.
No, I'm just kidding. No.
Did you actually write a theme in your book itself, or does it just come out, do you think? Like some sort of, at the end of the story, underlying, is there some sort of message you always try to get across in a book?
I don't think I'm ever setting out for that. No, I mean, I think there are kind of themes that I'm obsessed with that are kind of always showing up and appearing in whatever I'm writing. And then there are themes that kind of occasionally work themselves into a book. And so those things, and in this book, you know, I mean, I think like it's definitely, there's a lot about forgiveness and grief. You know, so that stuff, it's not something that I'm consciously thinking about at the outset, but certainly kind of, you know, comes to the surface as I'm working.
How long does it take you to write a book? And for instance, this book, what was the process for you? How long?
You know, it depends from book to book. This was written during the kind of early to middle stage of the pandemic. It was a pretty quick book, but I was, you know, I was home, I was working pretty nonstop. I didn't have.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Travel or other stuff that usually gets in the way and breaks up my writing time. This was probably the first draft of it was probably a few months, and then And then, you know, the revision process took a few months. So I think all told, it was probably, you know, 8 or 9 months.
Well, I was just wondering, has a character ever done anything to surprise you? Have they refused to do something or just kind of gone off the rails and decided they were going to do something that didn't kind of match up with the plot?
Yeah. I love that. That's one of my favorite things about writing is that even, yeah, I'm not a huge, or I wasn't in the beginning anyway, a huge planner. In the last couple of books, I've tended to figure things out a little bit more beforehand just so I could try to cut trouble off at the pass. But still, I always want to leave room for wandering and for exploration and for detours and just, you know, so I like that. And I like when, you know, I expect a character to turn right and they turn left and they do something that I wasn't expecting. So yeah, that's happened. And in this book, actually, this wasn't specifically one character, but there was it wasn't one character doing something. It was more that a character showed up who I had no intention of being in the book and just kind of took over at a certain point. So that was a really fun thing to have happen for me.
Are you one of those writers that you're able to sit down and kind of go, okay, I'm clear between, you know, 1 and 4 today, so I'm going to sit down and write, and then 7 o'clock tomorrow night, I'm clear, so I can write. Can you just sit down and turn it on, or do you have to be in a mood?
I require definitely early in the morning. I mean, if I can, when I'm working on something, I get up at 5 and I write from 5 to 8 or 5 to 9. And that's really usually the most important time to me, the time when I get the best writing done. And when I'm working on a book, I really, really prefer, if I can, to be doing it, every day. I mean, it's going to be obviously, you know, different for different people, but I try to work on books in stretches of time where I know I'm not traveling or not doing anything like that, so I don't lose the flow of it. But yeah, so it's really important for me to work early mornings usually, and then, you know, I tend to revise and kind of rework stuff in the afternoons, but mornings are really, really important for me.
How did COVID go for you in the way of writing? Did it affect the way you wrote, or did it change how you wrote, or any sort of process in there?
I don't mean to make it sound positive because it was such a terrible time in so many ways, but it was suited my lifestyle well, you know. I wrote early every morning, and I wrote for I wrote a lot, and I think I kind of allowed myself to get lost in that, and that kind of kept me sane during the hardest stretch of it. And you know, it also allowed me to, and my ideal day is writing and then reading and watching movies and listening to music and of course hanging out with my family. So that's pretty much what I was doing all the time, every day. And it really creatively was a good period for me because I was reading a lot, I was watching a lot of films, and when I'm doing that, it's kind of feeding the creativity, I think. And so it worked out. I mean, it was a pretty good time for me in terms of getting work done.
So do you think it was going to be a little bit darker the way you wrote? Did you kill more people in this book or feel more negative? Oh, it's just that, you know, because when you're in a, I don't know about you, but when you're sitting in a stressful environment,
yeah,
the things around you are really upsetting or going on. And even if it's not COVID, but when there's some other things going on, does that, and you're kind of under the gun, so to speak, to write, do you think it's a darker way of writing? Do you think you come out a little bit meaner? Or
I think, you know, actually maybe it worked the opposite for me a little bit because my books are generally pretty dark, and so I think on this book maybe I got a little bit more open there than I usually do, and maybe that had something to do with my mindset at the time. I was kind of looking for that hope where I could get it. I mean, it's, don't get me wrong, it's dark and it's got some it's pretty violent, and there's plenty of meanness in there, but there's also a little bit of hope shining through, I think. So,
wow. So you and I, if someone was, someone's never heard of you. I know.
Most people probably.
No, there might be one or two out there. They've never heard of you before. And they go, oh my God, who is this guy? And they were to buy one book. Which book would you recommend to them of yours to buy that you would kind of guess it would kind of cover what kind of writer you are?
I think I'm always kind of thinking about the most recent one. So I would say this one, Shoot the Moonlight Out. And if not this one, if somebody didn't want to buy a book in hardcover, I would say the last one, City of Margins, which kind of, to me, these two books are kind of a culmination of a lot of stuff that I've been building towards. And I think I've gone back, to the 90s and the early 2000s, which is a time that I like writing about a lot. So they're pretty representative, I think.
I was wondering, you've talked about some influences. Do you have any influences that might surprise fans?
Oh man. Yeah. I would imagine I've got a lot of influences that would surprise people. I think I'm all over the place in terms of what I like. And in fact, pretty often I think that, the stuff that people wouldn't expect, or as in terms of being influenced by things, I think it's important to read outside your genre and watch things outside your genre. And so I don't know, I don't even know where to start. I have so many influences that show up. One I can talk about, the director, I was just thinking about her, the director Lynn Shelton, who passed away last year. I think people would be probably surprised to know that I mean, her work is had a huge impact on me, and in particular on these last couple of books. So there's stuff like that, but there's stuff across the spectrum in terms of movies and music and books. I think old screwball comedies and pre-code cinema and all sorts of music and tons of writers. I mean, certainly, probably a lot of writers outside the crime fiction genre, literary writers, sci-fi writers, whatever. So yeah, tons of stuff.
Do you read Dave's books? Is that it? are you a big fan? Right. Come on. You're supposed to pick one of the hosts and say, yeah, I like it. Your writing has been a big influence on me.
Yeah, you guys have been a huge influence on me.
Now we're talking. We're going to get you on prime time now. This is like, no messing around here. Oh yeah, the 90s was a pretty good time for me. Did you really like the 90s? Is that why you go back there?
Well, it was just such a formative time for me. I was born in 78, so I was 12, turned 12 in 1990, and then I was, 22 or 21 or 22 at the end of the 90s. So it was this really, in terms of discovery, in terms of the writers I was reading, the films I was watching, the music I was listening to, it was all, everything comes back to that time, really. But it was also, I think, artistically, it was an interesting time in America. I mean, it was just a great independent film scene. There was great music scene. Even popular mainstream kind of stuff was good, at least for a stretch there in the early 90s. And so it was just, it was just this truly formative time for me. I started it in junior high and I ended it in college. And in that 10-year stretch, I discovered just everything, it was everything I loved, and also an aesthetic, Generation X kind of slacker aesthetic that still shapes me, I think.
Well, do you think, we've had 80s nostalgia. Do you think that 90s nostalgia has hit now, or are we still kind of waiting for that?
I don't know that I can't think of tons of good stuff that has come out that has been set in the 90s, or I can't think of, I guess, a ton of stuff that uses the 90s kind of in that period piece way that the 80s is used now. I mean, the 80s stuff has gotten a little bit out of hand, I think. There's just so much so much kind of bad 80s nostalgia, and you know, people just throw like a windbreaker on a character and give them a boombox or whatever, and call it the 80s. So I don't know. I mean, you know, I think the 90s is not as probably dramatic in terms of like fashion and kind of that weird 80s aesthetic, but you know, it's definitely. It's just the end of an era in so many ways. It's like, you know, pre 9/11, pre internet. Oh, well, you know, internet was out, but it wasn't, you know, a huge thing. Pre cell phone, certainly. So it's this kind of just this end of things. It was very, you know, independent spirit kind of stuff in terms of, film and music and literature. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I imagine there'll be probably a good amount of 90s nostalgia, and maybe it's happening and I just don't know it. But for me, it's just more of a personal thing that in terms of going back to the place when I lived there and when I knew it, because that's the way I see it in my mind and that's the way I remember it.
Yeah. You must read Dave's books, Boombox and a Windbreaker. You've got to be reading his stuff. Well, you know, the 90s was the last really happy time.
Yeah.
You know, because it seems like everyone's uptight and there's so many things that are happening and it's always this, you know, we're living in a tense world for some reason. Since 2000 seems like, to me, it feels that way. And the 90s seemed like a really good time. Plus, I got laid a lot in the 90s. So that was, yeah, things were much better. But what do I know, you know? So where do you plan on going with this? Kind of what's kind of your plan? Are you going to keep writing the crime fiction thriller sort of era, or are you going to kind of go somewhere different?
I intend to keep writing this world and developing this kind of universe of characters and whatever that I've come up with. I don't know, you know, I have other ideas certainly, but I think I'll probably stay pretty close to this. And even when I stray from it, it'll be of a piece with it tonally and atmospherically. I mean, I think I tend to write dark, character driven, place driven stuff, whether it ultimately is rooted in crime or not. But I have a very broad definition of what crime fiction is. So I'll probably always, through that lens, be writing some kind of crime fiction.
Yeah, you could have like the crime of the lizards. They wear dark glasses and they're
90s lizards.
Yeah. 90s lizards, yeah. 90s
lizards. Do you like the noir sort of thing, like the black sort of black and white sort of old detective sort of stories?
Oh yeah. I mean, I love that. That stuff really literally kind of changed my life. I just kind of looked across it when I was young and never really saw the world the same way again. So it was huge. It was a huge discovery for me as a kid. I tend to like, I'm not a huge detective. Like, I like plenty of detective stuff. I like Hammett and Chandler. Yeah, I like a lot of that stuff. But for the most part, I like the more kind of bleaker noir. Detour was a big film for me as a kid and still is. A huge influence on me.
Yeah, there's some really good I always watch the TCM one all the time.
Noir Alley.
Listen to the stations as well, like the old shows and stuff like that. They're I don't know, they have much more, I don't want to say they're better written, but they're just something more stimulating about them. There's that word.
Yeah, well, they are. I mean, they're all just tonally, atmospherically, and they look beautiful, and they're crisp, and they're, you know, even when they're grungy, they look good, and they're shadowy, and very often there were, you know, there were great directors involved, and there were great writers involved on so many of them. I was just thinking about this writer, Daniel Fuchs, who I love, who was a Brooklyn novelist, wrote novels in the 30s, and then went to Hollywood and wrote scripts, and he wrote Crisscross, which is one of the great noirs, and he wrote The Gangster, which is terrific. And so there were great novelists who were brought out there and were working on a lot of those things.
You ever imagine what it would be like to go back, and if you were alive in that time, if you would be able to be a writer then, and what your life would be like? And do you think you could make it in the 30s and 40s as a writer?
You know, I do think about that a lot. Obviously, it was a bad time for a lot of people. If you were a writer of color, or, you know, a person of color, or, you know, pretty much anybody, but not a white man, I guess it was not a good time. You know, probably not a thing you would want to imagine. But I mean, I am totally fascinated by that era, and so much fiction that I love comes out of that era, when people were just kind of figuring things out, and, you know, the movies were just really getting going. I do think about that, and I am influenced by so many writers from that time that it's hard not to get caught up imagining, or at least, you know, be fascinated by the subject and read about it as much as I can.
Well, I find it fascinating that during the war, and during all that, like the racism stuff and the anti-Jew sentiment and just everything else, that they were able, with all of that going on in the world and all that pain and destruction and killing and all this stuff going on, and really you didn't know how it was going to end back then. It would be all up in the air, so it would be a really fearful time. But it's amazing how much good material came out of that. And I just wonder now, with the COVID, for instance, and all the negativity the last few years, I wonder if we'll get the same sort of boom in good.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that's always interesting about that period to me is that, you know, very often they were working within constraints, right? Just like there's a, especially in by 30. mid-30s, there was the Hays Code in film, so they had to put a lot of the stuff under the surface, and they had to try to figure out ways to tell stories within the constraints of the code and still be effective. So I mean, I think it put tension on the storytelling, and probably ultimately in a lot of ways made it even better.
Yeah, I you know, I'd like to go back as long as I had like modern technology.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to live like that. Now, website contacts. How do you like people to find you?
Oh, I'm all over the place. My website is just WilliamMichaelBoyle.com, and I'm on Twitter, WMBoyle4, and other places, but those are probably the main ones.
Yeah. Of course, we'll have that on our website, so listeners can find you with one click and stuff like that. And do you have like a Tinder or Grindr? You want people to have, or no? You're staying away from that. Do you like interacting with people? Do you actually do that sort of thing, or are you kind of shy away from doing that?
Yeah, I always like interacting with people when we're talking about stuff we like, you know, so it's fun, you know, as long as that's what the conversation is, I love it, you know, and we're talking about books we like and movies we like and music we like. That's great. That's one of my favorite things in the world to do. Anything, you know, other than that, sometimes, I guess.
Yeah, you know, want to sit around and talk about Britney Spears and stuff. That's, that's, you know, the important things in life, right? You know. Well, it's certainly been a pleasure, and glad you could make it on. And everyone, you've got to go buy this book. This is the book to have. Now, it comes out November 2nd, so on air date, this should be the 3rd, so it should be out now. So there's no excuses. Pick up the book. It's called Shoot the Moonlight Out, and it's a novel. The author was our guest, William Boyle. Thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was great talking to you guys.
Thanks, William.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.